Over the years, New York City has served as a major stomping ground for artists of all musical genres. It's the birthplace of hip-hop, rap, and punk rock. The city's also served an important role in the history of jazz and blues. The city was once the musical playground of greats like Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and Miles Davis. This song is called Move, and is from Davis's album Birth of the Cool. Davis died in 1991. He's buried right across from another jazz great, Duke Ellington, at the Bronx's Woodlawn Cemetery. Good morning, I'm George Boldarchy, and this is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Despite its strong beginnings, New York City is no longer the jazz mecca it once was. Blues is also not as popular, and that has enthusiasts of both musical genres concerned. Enter Bob Puttigiano, president of the New York Blues and Jazz Society. He says the audience for blues and jazz is aging and the music's future is uncertain. Bob, welcome to Cityscape.
It's great to be here.
How would you describe the state of blues and jazz in the New York City area?
Tough.
Tough,
very,
huh?
Very tough. Yeah, well, I mean, New York City's been more of a jazz town. There's no question about that. Just look at the amount of clubs and you can see how much jazz support there is. But it's waning too. I think the demographics has caught up with a lot of us, and for my generation on further and maybe a little bit before me, as well as for blues. There used to be a great blues culture here, and after the death of Manny's Car Wash and Chicago Blues and several others, things started to go downhill where, you know, there's really just Terror Blues, B.B. King's for all the blues that they do. There's not, you know, it's maybe a third of the mix at best, and I'm being kind. And then you got to go to the burbs. Places like the Turning Point, who, you know, advertise and work closely with you and others, but places like Mexicali Live, but they're all part-time blues clubs. The only real full-time blues club in New York is Terra Blues.
So you're saying it's an aging fan?
I think it's an aging fan. I think, you know, I've seen this in earlier in my life where blues has fallen out of favor and then came, you know, made a strong comeback, and a lot of that had to do, I feel, you know, when Stevie Ray Vaughan and the Allman Brothers and all of that resurgence started happening in the 70s into the 80s, and that brought people on back to the blues. We don't have that person or that artist or that band anymore that's, you know, leading people back to the blues, and I think that's part of what's missing, and I think, as you say, the aging process too.
I always thought that more people got blues than jazz, but it seems like you're saying jazz is doing slightly better than blues.
Well, getting it and supporting it, I think, are two different things, right? I mean, so getting it, yeah, it's definitely more accessible. You don't have the complex rhythms and jamming and you know, the type of interplay, typically. I mean, there's some blues bands that do offer a lot of color in their playing, but that's not the norm. And jazz is definitely less accessible. There's no question about that. But I think, you know, people are not aware of it anymore. It doesn't get the airwave coverage that it used to. And FM radio back in the day, and especially in the 60s and 70s, was very kind to mixing in a Freddie King, an Albert King, a B.B. King, just to name the top three, a Buddy Guy, whatever. And that's how I got hip to blues growing up as a kid in the lower side of Manhattan. Plus, bands were playing more blues, too. But bands were more important in the day, right? And it's not the same as it was. The culture is very different.
Who are among the up-and-coming blues bands or jazz bands of today, would you say?
I think the most established up-and-coming would be Derek Trucks, because he's got very strong blues roots. He also has, you know, pretty good jazz roots, too. He's definitely a rocker, but he's definitely a roots-based band. So if there's anybody that can move some mountains and bring some people to the fore, I'd have to put him at number one. I see my brother.
What do you think old-time blues lovers think of this guy or people like him?
That's a very good question, because I find that the old-time, old-school blues people are not so accepting to youth and a rockish sound. Some are. Some are very strong and very passionate about it. But if I took a percentage rap, I would say it'd probably be a 50-50 split at best.
Your group, the New York Blues and Jazz Society, was formed to help preserve these musical genres, blues and jazz. How exactly do you go about doing that?
Website is our beacon, you know, nybluesandjazz.org, if I may. Just a not-for-profit, just like WFUV. You know, our goal is really just to keep people informed, try to offer as many giveaways as we can from concert venues and CDs from artists and labels and all that kind of stuff. And just keep, you know, we send out emails regularly and all of that just to keep, you know, keep the blues alive, to coin a overused phrase.
I know a big part of your mission is to educate young people. How do you do that? How do you explain blues and jazz to an audience unfamiliar with this kind of music?
It's another difficult task. I mean, when I, even in another life, what I do at another college station, I mean, getting people, younger people involved is very difficult. They aren't aware. I mean, it's interesting. I was interviewing and talking with Nick Ashford a couple of days ago, and he's doing a blues series on Tuesday nights at the Sugar Bar on 72nd Street in Manhattan. Not a commercial. It's just what it is, right? And he says, you know, it's funny. So I guess I'm pretty much the same question you just asked me. And I said, what about youth? And he says, when we get a decent amount, I'd say maybe 25% to 30%. He says, but the best part is when we get them there, they're dancing and loving it. So it's an exposure thing. I think you hit the nail on the head, George.
Do you also, though, try to show them where the influence is in the music that they're listening to day in and day out? Because there's a lot of influence there.
There's a lot of influence. I don't know if the... How did I say this? I don't know if the drill down effort is there anymore. We grew up in a different age where, you know, we were looking at albums and looking at names on albums and looking who wrote songs. I mean, in an iPod world, an MP3 world, and a download world, I mean, that stuff is getting lost in the mixture. And I don't know if that desire is there to drill down as far. I don't have a good handle on it. But I think a lot of it is lost because we don't have, you know, even CD covers, never mind LP covers to do research with or look at and read the liner notes and all of that. It's becoming a lesser influence for people. So it makes it difficult for getting that information at people. Plus, I think people, younger people today, they want to hear it and then they'll make a decision on it. It's different culture.
Who would you point to, though, as a popular commercial artist and tell a young person, you know what, if it weren't for blues, this artist wouldn't be doing what they're doing today, and perhaps this is your favorite artist?
Eric Clapton. Easy. I mean, you know, Eric Clapton to me, and there was just a discussion on some of the blues boards just this week, and, you know, Bluesell is a place where a lot of people chime in. And, you know, again, it was like a 50-50 split saying, I don't get Eric Clapton. Others saying nobody's done more for the blues than Eric Clapton has. I'm on the camp of I feel like he's done an awful lot for blues artists and the blues music and keeping it going. To look at the Crossroads festivals. I mean, phenomenal. His albums. I mean, there's always some blues on his records. And as he ages gracefully, I think it's more of that in his playing. I mean, some of the live stuff they put out recently has been, I think, spectacular. I won't say the best playing of his life, but definitely the tastiest playing of his life.
You mentioned LPs a moment ago, and I know that you have a collection of some 10,000 LPs.
And slow, it's not growing like it used to, but it grows. I still go out there on eBay and wherever, and I don't go through the shops as much as I did, you know, as a kid doing that kind of stuff. But and plus, there aren't as many outlets and shops around. The record stores have become pretty much a foregone conclusion. But yeah, no, I'm a big collector, and I also collect CDs. I mean, I like the physical. I mean, it's, again, we're creatures of habit. We grew up, you know, in a certain way. We like to keep. I keep current. I do downloads. I don't like the sounds of MP3s. I could tell you that. I mean, if I'm going to download something, I want a WMV or something that has a full-bodied sound. And I'm really not 100% sold still on the CD sound, and I do prefer the glow and warmth of LPs.
Let me ask you
this. As an audiophile.
Let me ask you this question. If you had to get rid of all of your LPs but one, which one would you keep?
Oh, this may throw you off. Because it's not going to be a blues recording.
Really?
Yeah, it's going to be the Grateful Dead.
Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, Europe 72, 3-LP set.
And which blues recording, though, would you keep?
Blues would probably be BB. No, it would be BB. And the album Completely Well, which is the album that had Thrill Is Gone on it, which is an overlooked record because of the great success of The Thrill Is Gone being his signature hit forever and covered by countless many. But the whole album is very, very strong. It's beyond just The Thrill Is Gone. People just say, oh, yeah, that's the one with Thrill Is Gone, and they don't know anything else about the record. That's a mistake because there's some really great jamming. If you like BB in a youthful, upbeat way, whoa, man, this is great.
Would you say that B.B. King has been the most important voice in blues?
Without question. I've ridden the bus with him and had the lucky opportunity to chat with him. And he takes his role seriously as an ambassador to the music, blues music, that is.
We talked about B.B. King as perhaps being the most important voice in blues. Who would you say has been the most important voice in jazz?
in jazz of recent times or ever?
Whatever you want, whoever you think is the most important.
You got to go back to Coltrane. I mean, you know, you got to go. I mean, anybody who's worth the salt that's made records over the years has become, you know, the Pat Metheny's of the world and later day generation of jazz players. They all look back and, you know, it's always Miles, it's always, you know, Train, Monk, Dizzy. Those are, you know, the core crew. Bird, of course, Parker, Charlie Parker. I mean, these always come back around. Everybody wants to go investigate the roots of jazz. That's usually where it comes from.
Bob, once again, your website?
nybluesandjazz.org.
Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. It's been fun.
Bob Puttigiano is president of the New York Blues and Jazz Society. The group's online at nybluesandjazz.org. You're tuned to Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Good morning once again. I'm George Bodarkey. This morning, we're focusing our attention on blues and jazz in New York City. Some enthusiasts say the genres are on the decline, but don't tell that to our next guest. Jazz is his life. We welcome this morning to Cityscape jazz saxophonist extraordinaire and Harlem legend, Bill Saxton. He's joined by his lovely wife this morning, Theda Palmer Saxton. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, George.
Bill, we should point out that you are also the Bill in the jazz club Bill's Place in Harlem. You opened this place back in 2005, right? Late 2005?
Correct. It's part of a dream. You know, we all have dreams, you know. I had played with many great people that I wanted to play with, but I always wanted to bring something back to the community where I was born and where I grew up. So I decided to open up a jazz club and to not serve alcohol, although you're allowed to bring your own.
BYOB at Bill's, huh?
We don't serve it. So it's friendly to children, young people, and it's all about the music and bringing something back.
Theda, what was your role in all of this?
Major.
I discovered the building. I get up early and I'm always surfing the internet, and I saw this property. And I said, this looks interesting. It was zoned for the right things and location was interesting. So I said, Bill, you should wake up. It's, you know, wake up a musician at 9 o'clock and say, let's go look at a building.
She said, you have to get up. You have to go with me.
I said, no, there's something that I think you must get
up to see. We have
to
check this out.
This is a brownstone building, right?
Yeah, it's a brownstone.
And so he says, you know, I'm not doing that. I said, you have to get up. So, okay, I'm half sleeping, you know, recalcitrant person goes with me, and we're standing outside of this really strange-looking building next to a church.
On 133rd, right?
It's at 148 West 133rd Street between Lenox and 7th. And the owner is there, and he shows us around, and it's a step up from being really almost a dump. And I said, oh, what great potential. Bill's eyes are probably still closed. I'm not really sure. He said nothing. He sat down and had nothing to say the entire time I saw the building. In fact, I'm not even sure if he remembers the man's name at that point. And so we go home, and I tell the man I'm interested. Bill goes back to bed. So the next day, I arrange to see the building later in the day when Bill is awake, anytime after 2 o'clock, because, you know, you don't get it, you know, get in very late in the evening. And we get in the building, and I say, it has potential. He says, oh, okay, fine, if you think so. And that's how it started. And having no information about anything, we knew that it was a great find, great location. And my background is theater. And I saw it as a great space that could be used as a creative place for things to happen for me and for him. That's sort of how it started out.
But then you learned later that mm-hmm. this location was once a speakeasy in the 1920s.
Well, exactly. Let Bill tell you what happened. This happened through a friend of his, like an angel.
A neighbor of ours where we live. You know that paper that they give you when you go into the subway called the New York Press? Well, they had an article called The Rise and the Fall of the Original Swing Street, 133rd Street. That was a front page article. Mm-hmm. And in the article, they had the addresses of the speakeasies in 133rd Street. And it also talked about there was about 150 such places throughout Harlem during Prohibition.
Harlem was the epicenter of jazz,
right.
No question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't, you know, in the history books, they're always talking about 52nd Street.
That's the Imitation.
It started in Harlem. It started on 133rd Street. They used to call that block Swing Street. One thing about names in Harlem, you know, if you meet a guy or somebody, you know, and they say Bushead, it's because he has a bus head. If they call it Swing Street, that meant that the street was really, really swinging because the names always meant something. And our address was in there. And we said, oh, my. But we had already opened the club. The club had started, you know. It's a very narrow place, but it doesn't give you a sense of being as small as it really, really is.
I understand that every seat at Bill's place is a front row seat.
Absolutely.
Every seat is a good seat.
They're all good seats. Everyone. All good seats, yeah. Absolutely.
And we have also a lovely garden. Again, compliments to my wife. You know, she has good hands, green things. Things grow around her. Even people grow around her.
So how much does Bill's place reflect the old days of jazz in Harlem?
Precisely, let me just say this. The decor that came, having nothing to do with understanding the why, came purely from the architecture and the feel of what it had been. And so what I did, unknowing the history, was put it back together the way I would have imagined it when it was built. So I did a historical, as much as I could, you know, reproduction of what I thought a house, a living room, a parlor would be, with a performance space. And that's what it turned out to be.
And again, without knowing the history.
History.
All this was done.
So when we found out the history, the place was exactly as it should have been for 1927.
Unbelievable.
Every single thing, down to the artwork, everything. The molding, the light fixtures, everything.
Everything.
So you see, it was meant to be.
Now, were you both born and raised in Harlem?
Oh, no. I'm from St. Louis.
Bill, you, though?
I was born in Harlem Hospital.
Two blocks away from the club.
Two blocks away?
He was. He's
that's
in
where
there.
Harlem Hospital
you can
is.
See Harlem Hospital
it's on
133rd Street.
Yeah.
How much was music a part of your childhood in Harlem, Bill?
Well, you know, back in when I was growing up in the record stores, they used to have these big speakers. And they would play their music like through these speakers. So as a child, just running around the street, I heard so many things, you know, all that I didn't even know. I even heard this record by Louis Farrakhan called The White Man's Heaven is a Black Man's Hell. I remember that as a kid, hearing that. And we used to laugh, you know, and go on about our business. I also heard Art Blakey. I also heard Paul Robeson. They used to play music. So, and then I had a neighbor who was really influential. She used to, doing her housework on Saturday mornings, she played jazz till she finished her housework loud. So I had to hear all this stuff. So I started, little did I know, I'm a kid running around playing, he was shooting scullies in the street and doing whatever we were doing at that particular time. And I was hearing all this music. It was soaking in. Not a musician, because there are no other musicians in my whole family. My father played the saxophone a little bit, but he never got past just a hobby sort of thing.
How old were you when you first started playing the sax?
Oh, I was 18. Mm-hmm. Although I did have music exposure when I was in junior high school, Frederick Douglass, so I played the clarinet, but I wasn't good. I was terrible. As a matter of fact, the teacher who was the teacher then, he was surprised that out of all the people in his class, that I would become a professional musician, because I really was like, I was playing like fourth clarinet, you know.
I understand that you used to tote your saxophone around in a pillowcase.
Well, that's because I didn't have a saxophone case. My first saxophone came to me in such a way that the case didn't come with it. So the only way I could carry it around that made sense, if I carried it in any place, I had to carry it in a pillowcase until I got a case. I didn't have the whole saxophone.
You didn't have the whole saxophone. No. How did you play it?
I didn't. I wanted it. Oh, God. You're making me tell the story.
Yeah.
George.
We want to know.
Well, the story goes like this. It's back in 1964, they had a riot in Harlem. And people just went crazy, you know. We destroyed our own community. And I've never thinking that, you know, we'd have to go somewhere to get the things that we were destroying. You know, but it was a statement that had to be made, you know, because enough was enough already. And this pawn shop, I used to walk past this pawn shop every day and look at the saxophone, just look at it, because there's something about the saxophone and the keys and the mechanisms that, and also the engraving, you know, it's a lot. They're really beautiful. After the riots, this friend of mine came up with the saxophone. So I acquired it from him. But it didn't have the whole thing. It didn't have the neck. It just had the body of the saxophone, which I didn't know. I wasn't too sure either. But
did you try to play it without the neck?
Couldn't play it. So I had it. I put it in a pillowcase because I had to figure out what was I going to do with it next. Had not figured out my next move. And then shortly after that, my family moved from Harlem down to the Lower East Side, where Jackie McLean, his son Renee, and a bunch of young musicians who were all influenced by... Jackie McLean was quite a guy. Let me tell you about him. Anybody around him was affected by him all the way until the time he died when he moved to Hartford, Connecticut. So he had these bunch of young musicians walking around with their horns thinking, you know, striving to be musicians. And they walked right behind him. He always had a big thing with young people. So when I moved down there and I met Jackie McLean, I thought I had died and gone to heaven, you know, because I knew who he was. And it was one of his students, a friend of mine named Patrick, and another one of Jackie's proteges, Nelson Samaniego, who took me to the music store and got me fitted up with a neck and got a case for my horn. And then I was ready to do business.
Do you still have that saxophone?
No, no. What happened with that was, well, downtown, Avenue D was the area. They still had gangs. And one day this guy walked up to me and he accused me of doing something that I had no knowledge of because I wasn't from the neighborhood. So we ended up fighting. And the same saxophone that I went through all these changes from to get together got stolen from me.
That is some story.
I was brokenhearted. I had just started to get into it, and my mother, very humble beginnings, she saw how upset I was, and she took her last money, very last, and brought me a saxophone. Yeah.
And that is how an amazing career got started,
huh? That's
when
it really began. That's when it got real serious.
We should point out, though, that you do have a degree in jazz music, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I do. I have an artist diploma, and I have a BA from the New England Conservatory of Music.
You've appeared with, you've recorded with a number of jazz giants during your career, including the Duke Ellington and Count Basie Orchestras, Nancy Wilson, Clark Terry. What for you has been your most memorable moment to date? Because I know you're not done yet.
No, I'm not done yet. I guess my most... I don't know. Oh, one of my, because when I graduated from the New England Conservatory, I got a call from Mongo Santa Maria. And I'll never forget this because the book of music that they had was like big as a phone book, a New York City phone book, very thick, all filled with music. And I said, and nobody played with music written in front of them, you know. And I was like, how in the heck am I going to ever memorize all of this? And they knew it. And he never played the same thing all the time. He had his favorites, you know, but how am I going to ever learn this? And then after playing, you know, I auditioned, got the gig, you know, started working. So I started working kind of high profile right away, right out of college. And so when I memorized that book, and I could stand there just like everybody else, and he could just say, we're going to play this, and we're just going to play it. I thought that's major for me. That was major. I didn't know how I was going to do it.
You've also composed many compositions, about 80 or so, right?
Yes, and many musicians. Some of my tunes have been recorded by other musicians, and I think that's the biggest compliment that anyone could ever have, if somebody likes your writing enough to record it. I mean, everybody writes, but, you know. So I look at that as really... a compliment, the highest compliment, you know, somebody you can ever get, somebody want to record your music, you know.
What would you say is your favorite
Well, one of my that's been recorded a couple of times, a tune called Beneath the Surface, which I originally recorded with the late, great John Hicks, Alvin Queen, and Ray Drummond, and that works. That one works. Even there are lyrics to it. There's a vocalist working on it right now to perform it as, you know, as a vocal. So,
Theda, do you have a favorite Bill Saxton composition?
I think that's my favorite.
Well, give me the details one more time about Bill's place, where you are, and give me some more details about when people can come by and hear some of this amazing music.
Well, we're at 148 West 133rd Street. That's between Lenox and 7th, or between, you tell them, the one of the things that you love.
Malcolm X and Adam Clayton Power Boulevard.
There you go.
We love that. And open only on Fridays. And anytime after 9:30. It's wonderful. Bring your own brown bag, because as in Prohibition, we don't serve alcohol, really. You bring your own. And phone number is for reservations is what, Bill?
212-281-0777.
Reservations required or recommended?
Recommended, because it's a small space.
Theda Palmer Saxton, thank you so much for coming in.
Sure.
And husband Bill, thank you.
How'd you know about that pillowcase?
I do my research.
I guess you do. I don't talk about that.
And I'm going to give you a copy of my book.
Great. Thank you both.
You don't have it.
Bill Saxton is a jazz saxophonist. He and his wife, Theda Palmer Saxton, own Bill's Place, a jazz parlor in Harlem. This is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Jazzmobile is a New York City-based organization that hosts concerts, festivals, and special events to keep jazz alive, not just in the five boroughs, but around the world. One of the highlights of their summer jazz festival is a vocal competition where participants compete for the title of the best jazz vocalist. Cityscape joins the audience at Harlem's Uptown Grand for the contest, held back in July.
The grand prize consists of Bragging Rights, 2010 Best of the Best Jazz Vocalist. I'd like to invite Miss Shirley Crabb to the stage.
Hi, my name is Shirley Crabb, and I am a contestant in Jazzmobile's Best of the Best Vocal Jazz Competition. Music is everything that I do. I love to sing.
Your masterful baton, come on and swing it.
When I'm singing jazz, I compare it to dancing. I just feel so free.
My name is Marianne Sullivan, and I am a contestant in the Jazzmobile's vocal competition. Professional jazz vocalist, playing a lot in the New York City area, doing some touring here in the U.S. as well as in Europe, and I work for the Brooklyn Queens Conservatory teaching elementary school music.
All my bridges burn by.
I would describe my passion for jazz as very deep, very much more than just the music, but jazz as a culture, jazz as a scene, jazz as a community has been very, very important to me in my years since starting singing this music, and it's just something that has become part of who I am.
Jazzmobile's annual vocal competition in New York City. Check the group out online at jazzmobile.org. And it's time to bring out the jazz hands for the end of this week's Cityscape. Remember, you can get past editions of Cityscape and learn how to podcast the show at WFUV.org. We're also now on Facebook and Twitter, listed as WFUV Cityscape. Sign up, become a fan, and a follower. I'm George Bodarkey. My thanks to senior producer Andrea McCrary and producer Maureen Chin. Have a great weekend.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down.